This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, my voice is steadily getting better, but it's taking a day at a time, basically. It's better now than it was, and but it's still not my regular voice, so stay tuned. Maybe next week I'll be better. Who knows? But in the meantime, we have a fantastic guest that I'm going to introduce here this week. Tom Peterson has been traveling the U.S. on a recent lecture tour. I had been wanting him to come on a tour for a long time. I don't recall when, if ever, he's actually done any kind of a tour, let alone we might have done a one-off here and there. In fact, I did see him back in 2016 on a streaming video on the Magic Circles website when he was lecturing there, and I was very impressed. I had heard of Tom Peterson actually first through Gregory Wilson, if you might recall, back when we had that ongoing series about Gregory Wilson, that Tom was one of the people who had spoken on Greg's behalf. Nevertheless, I have just been wanting to get him out on a tour, and I'm so glad I did, because my gosh, if you haven't had a chance to see his lecture, and he comes back anywhere near you again, you need to see him, because I'd say it's one of my top 10 best lectures, because every single thing he did was commercial, something that you could use. It was very easy, not a lot of finger flinging. I had things from mentalism to close up to stand up and comedy and serious, a little bit of everything, and plus just a genuinely nice guy to boot. He lives in the UK currently and is from the US, so that's why he doesn't have an English accent. He has an American accent, but he also works a lot of cruise ships and some corporate things, and you'll be hearing all that in this upcoming podcast. I also want to thank all of you who are subscribing to the newsletter, and if you don't subscribe to our weekly newsletter, there are some reasons that you should. And in fact, if you had received this week's newsletter, you will understand why. So anyhow, thank you guys, and if you're interested, all you have to do is whenever you go to themagicwordpodcast.com, there should be a little pop-up that will come up and say subscribe to our newsletter, or you can go to the tab that says subscribe to our newsletter there. Anyhow, please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Tom Peterson, here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for TheMagicWordPodcast.com, and today I've got with me a guest who comes to us. Are you in England? Living in England, actually?
Still living in England.
In England. Yeah. And you can tell by his accent right there also. But the reason is, I guess, he picks up that American accent from all the cruise ships and everything and places you're working in.
Jolly good.
There yes. You go. and he has also recently been lecturing across the U.S., and if he's not lectured in your place, you have to catch him the next time through. Please welcome Mr. Tom Peterson.
Hey there, Tom. Hey, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a great pleasure for me to have an opportunity to actually chat with you on this, because I've been wanting to talk with you for quite a while, because I think you were a very interesting fella, not just what you have to share magic-wise, but I like your marketing scheme. You know, when the emails I get from you are really kind of cool. They have that like 50-ish kind of a vibe or something to it that's kind of a retro. Is that part of your brand or something?
Yeah, I've always been a real fan of the Atomic Age 1950s. Yeah. I mean, I grew up with like Dick Van Dyke and Carol Burnett and, you know, all the old...
And the Jetsons
and exactly, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, very much my style.
So do you actually draw those on yourself, or do you talk to a guy who does comics? And
say, No. I've got that much time on my hands. I'm a one-man shop. So I do all my own graphics. I do all my own manufacturing.
Really?
Everything from soup to nuts is, I mean... Even the cloth items I sell, I sew myself. So I am my own sweatshop. Yeah.
Well, I know that like the quack up that you got, which is
the Wise Quack.
Is that what it is?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Wise
yep.
Quack. I remember when you were lecturing on that. When I first saw your lecture, it was at the Magic Circle in London.
Oh, okay.
And which I happened to watch not live, but I had they put it
on the streaming.
Kind yes, of. On yeah, a stream yeah. thing that we had for the closed group in the Facebook page. And for members only. So I was watching that, and I thought, man, this is brilliant. It's like, that's good. Well, that's good. Well, that's good also, you know. And what was that, 2 years ago, I guess?
At least 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Two or 3 years ago.
Yeah. And so anyhow, I had, when you explained that, I didn't know if you were selling those or, you know, I didn't have the Wise Quack to begin with. Yeah. So I went down and made my own. So I wish I had brought that to show you, because I saw the tiddlywinks you have are much smaller. I actually use a poker chip.
Oh, excellent.
On the bottom.
Okay.
And yeah, so then I covered it, you know, then with
whiteboard material that I need. But then also, anyhow, I'm not going to expose the method or everything, but the point is that it's a larger disc than the one that you use for the duck. I've got the same size duck, but it's white on yellow as opposed to yellow on yellow. But it's a little bit different. We can talk about this off air, but the point is I kind of made it my own thing, and I put that into my act also. And I just think it's fantastic. I think it's very clever. I like it. I mean, there are not many mentalism tricks that are out there that actually have comedy.
Well, that's high praise. And I've actually, what's funny about that, I think at the time I did the Circle lecture, I was not selling that. I do sell it as a complete package now. Most of everything I sell now is, I sell because I originally just started telling people how to make stuff.
Yeah.
And they'd say, they'd come to me later and they'd say, yeah, could you just make it for me instead? So I'm happy to do that now. But yeah, I wasn't making it at the time, and it's one of the few tricks that I've got some friends who are doing it, and they actually do it in kids shows, which isn't
Well, I guess that makes sense.
Isn't how I designed it, but you know what? It's one of the few I think mentalism tricks you can do for kids shows where you know you don't lose the kids. So
that's a very good point. There are not many mentalism. You know, I came up with a mentalism trick that I use for kids. That it's a it's not really a coloring book, but it's the trick that uses. You know what I'm talking about, where it is Teddy Bear's favorite, I think Bo Goldman had this out, Teddy Bear's favorite magic trick where that basically it's using, I think...
Oh, was this the card slot reveal shuffle? Where it goes through...
The other person shuffles the cards upside down, you hand them to you, and then they come back upside down, and you
very
go back
clever.
And forth, and at the end, you say, okay, there'll be 13 cards face up, and they count them all, and then the next time, it's like, okay, 7 will be black, and 6 will be red, and they'll all be spades, except,
the
one, it's like, that's a 4 of clubs, or whatever. You know what
Yeah, I know
about?
Exactly the trick
okay,
you're
so my
about.
Idea, and people who are listening to this then can use this then as well, is I use it with flashcards. So you've got things with children, so this way that they can relate to that. And I had everything that was like B. There's a bat and a boy and a ball, you know, or a bird and different things like that. So at the end, I said, all things begin with a B also, except one, which was an I. It was an ice cream cone. They said, oh, there's one that's an ice cream cone. And then except for the ice cream cone, which is, you know. And I call this, my granddaughter's name was Sarah. So I said, Sarah's favorite card trick. So when they go through the booklet that I made, you know, so my point is it was mentalism for children then also. And there are very few things you can think of, you know, that are going to be doing that.
Great idea. That's a great
but,
idea.
Well, there you go. It's in my lecture. So something where people are listening, get a free, you can make one up yourself. Just get some flashcards. But explain the effect, I guess, for people who have not seen Wisequack.
Yeah, the effect is basically I start out by bragging that I'm very good at carnival games. Well, one game in particular, I'm very good at the pick a duck game. I win almost every time. And most people who've ever been to a carnival or in the UK, they call it fun fairs, are familiar with the game where the ducks float by and you grab them by their little heads and you turn them over and on the bottom is a 2 or 3 digit number. And it corresponds to just the most amazing prizes you've ever seen. Anything from pencil erasers to pencil toppers. Basically, you've got a choice of all kinds of great stuff.
And, great school supplies.
Yeah, exactly. And so I say, I've gotten so good at this that my local carnival's actually retired my duck. And here's how I've gotten good at it. And we have the audience collectively come up with a 3-digit number, and then in plain view the whole time on a table off to my side, off to my right, usually is a paper bag, and we get the spectator up on stage who started the number sequence out. He holds onto the pad of paper displaying the 3-digit number. He looks inside the paper bag. He sees there's a duck, pulls it out, and inscribed on the bottom of the duck is the number that matches what the audience chose. So
killer.
It's my take on the Al Karan medallion trick. I've never had any luck presenting serious mentalism, try as I may. And so for me, this is a fun kind of casual way of doing mentalism without it, you know, degrading down into vampire stories and everything.
Yeah, that has just so many opportunities, I think, to have comedy written into that, you know, with the rubber duck and different things you can say about it in your childhood. I mean, that obviously not just taking your routine, which is golden, but other things that you can add to that and the music that you can use, rubber ducky and whatnot, you know, to bring people on and set them down and everything.
I hadn't thought of that. It's actually a really good idea. All right. Now it's going to be released with a soundtrack.
which is what that I've done. And actually, there are a couple of little things. There's one that's called Techno Duck, I think, that's you have to look it up on YouTube or something. And so when somebody comes up, it's kind of a little dance thing. And so I kind of have them wiggle their back behind, you know, kind of like a little duck would. You
wasn't
know?
There a song back in the 70s called Disco Duck?
Disco Duck,
yeah,
yes, there was.
So there
yes.
Boy, I'm dating myself there.
Not much at all. So that's why that your marketing is for the retro stuff.
Exactly. Exactly, exactly.
You think that way.
Yeah, exactly.
You live in that world. Exactly. You really have an advance. So you're moving up to the 1970s.
Absolutely,
shortly.
Absolutely.
Nothing wrong with that, my friend.
Yep.
Well, as far as some of the mentalism, have you really tried a lot of serious mentalism way back when? And
yeah, when I first started doing stand-up magic, it started out with me trying to figure out a way to take my close-up magic and just play it bigger, which is, I think, how a lot of guys get into stand-up magic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, and because most of what I was doing at the time, I was a close-up guy, so most of it was, you know, cards and coins and, you know, kind of the usual bill of fare. And so things that kind of fit in my pocket and play large were mentalism pieces. So I was doing a mm-hmm. really serious character at one point.
Really?
When I first started doing stand-up magic, I was dead serious. I was very dark. And so, yeah, a lot of mentalism kind of worked its way into my show. And mm-hmm. then one night on stage, I was working in Minneapolis at a place called Magic, which was part of this big nightclub complex. I think I got a laugh on stage, and it was all over. After that, I'm like, no, I'd much rather get laughs. So
that was your first taste of crack, right?
Yep,
there.
Yeah, pretty like, much.
Wow,
pretty
that
much.
Is awesome.
Yeah, yeah. First one was free.
Yeah.
Second one I had to pay for. Yeah,
you had to write some material. Next
absolutely,
time.
Absolutely. Yep.
And that's what starts to grind. Yeah, it's like, okay, I'm going to write another line. Okay, and then you work that into the show for a while. And it's like, yeah, if it laughs, they laugh or not or whatever. But you know, you don't kill something just because it doesn't work the first time or two. You know, it's just the wrong audience, and you know what that's like. Sometimes that you think, okay, well, they really like it, and you try it again, and it's just not working, you know? It just depends a lot on the audience.
My buddy Mike Bent has got arguably one of the funniest routines I've ever sat and witnessed. He calls it Smell-O-Rama.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me when I first complimented him on that, he said it was a hard year of working that thing before it got funny.
Mm-hmm.
So, boy, he's got more wherewithal than I do. I don't think I could stand a whole year of silence before I started getting big laughs. But
well,
I'm sure he wasn't getting silence. I didn't mean it that way.
Well, and likewise, I was going to say with David Copperfield, working with that alien thing that he has in his show, that I've heard people say initially when he was working on this, 2 years ago or a year and a half, long time ago, apparently, it's like it really wasn't working. It wasn't funny. He was interacting with this little puppet that was kind of like an alien.
Oh, I don't think I'm familiar with this at all. Okay.
But he loved it and still likes it has it in the show. And he, you know, featured piece. Now he's got this, you know, spaceship and everything else. But he kept thinking, nope, there's something there. You know, the point is he kept working it and he had the perfect place that he can continue. And whenever that you sandwich something that around a new piece, then you feel comfortable going in and coming out because you know they're going that something's going to be solid. You can always work in that new stuff, you know, kind of in the middle kind of a thing. And I'm guessing that was kind of how that he got that started. But he had confidence that, nope, okay, I'm going to tweak it. I'm not going to throw it out. You know, this has got something in there.
Something funny here, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, David Copperfield's arguably the hardest working guy in our business. So,
yeah.
If anyone's going to make it work, he's going to do it. So,
yeah. You know, I was very fortunate when I just went to Johnny Thompson's service. I had an opportunity then afterwards, I was invited to go on the tour of his museum.
Oh, wow.
Chris Kenner had asked me to come. It's like, wow, who, me? Really? So it was okay. So there were like nine of us, Jamie and Swiss and Paul Gertner and Christopher Hart and some of us, Danny Orleans and some other guys, you know, were there also. So anyhow, there was one point in which we were looking at his Houdini collection, or part of it at least, and that he had this milk can. And as we were walking through, the base of it is sitting on a square wooden, probably a 4-inch base or something. Okay. And he's got so much stuff, he'd almost trip over things when you kind of walk. He's got a nice pathway. I mean, of course, that. But as he did, of course, there are people, he's got people around him as we're going through the museum. And I think his foot, you know, kind of hit that. And he said, can you fix this base, make sure that it's round instead of square? And I'm guessing that the very next night they probably had a different base, you know, on that, underneath that thing. So he's that much of a perfectionist. He's always, and I've heard it before, like when he's on stage, you know, that he'll always say, let's work on this. You know, next time that, we'll, you know, he's got a microphone that's talking to the people in the backstage, you know, that have the illusion turned this way, or, you know, turn up the music next time, or that, you know, have the sword blade so it's facing the other direction or something. Just minor tweaks as you're going.
Well, I think I might have heard this from an old tape that Joni Spina had put out years ago before she passed away, where she was talking about working with David Copperfield and how every night after the show they all sat on the bus and they watched the film from that night and they went through it kind of routine by routine.
Wow.
Here's what worked, here's what didn't, every night. And tell you what, that's dedication.
But in that case, yeah, that's not only dedication because they're on the bus and they got some time to kind of look at it and view it and work on it then again. But then again, like what he is doing is in real time telling him what to do, try to correct this. Mm. But I was backstage with Chris Angel one time and before he really, you know, he was sitting down with Banachek and myself, but as we were doing that, he had three people there with clipboards. And before he really started chatting with us, he said, "Hey, how you doing?" He said, "Let me get you something to drink here just a minute, but I need to talk to my people while this is fresh on my mind." And he was going through the show, and these people were jotting down things. So, well, next time I want this to happen, or the spot was too high, hot, or I needed more of a green light on this, you know, on different things. And so he was telling, they were writing it all down so that in the second, even the next show, you know, that it would be adjusted to be whatever that he saw. So you really got to be present and in the moment to kind of know what happened in order to try to adjust it. It's nice to have the opportunity, obviously, to do the shows kind of back to back, so you can kind of tweak that, as opposed to saying, okay, when I do my next show next Christmas, you know, that I'm going to get a new table or something.
I tell you what, that's what the Magic Castle is so good about, is you get to try stuff out like over and over again. If something doesn't work, like in another 20 minutes, you get to try it again.
There are a few venues like that where you do have an opportunity.
It's such a rarity, rarity.
So. Now, when you're working like cruise ships, that I know there are various ways of doing it. When I'd worked it, I'm working on the same ship, and so you have to have a different act, you know, A, B, and C show. But I know sometimes guys will work where that you will get off the ship, and then another one will pick you up, and you can do the same act on this next ship. So you're not working with the same audience. You ever do that?
I did a lot of transshipping. I spent about 15 years of my life doing ships, and most of the time, though, I was on a ship from anywhere from 10 days to 2 weeks, and in that given time, depending on the line I was working with, I'd do a show once, maybe twice during that whole period. So it's, you know, and at the outset, that sounds like, oh, that's such an easy job, but when your entire reputation is resting on that one night, you sink or swim on that one night, and you got to live on the ship with those people for the rest of the cruise, it's a lot of pressure. But it, unfortunately, that, I mean, I think Princess, towards the end of my career with Princess, they were doing three seatings, and that was nice because it was a 1-2-3. It was the same show three times for three different seatings, and you kind of got to try things a little bit and with that. But it's one of those things where then you go home and you're home for a week, and then you get back on a ship, and by the time you're done, it's been, you know, 3 weeks before you do your show again. So it's not as fresh in your mind,
as fresh, as immediate.
Yeah,
it's great if you can kind of do that over, which is nice about working restaurants when you're doing close-up, obviously, because you're working table to table, and you can really hone that slight that you're working
restaurants
on.
Restaurants are the best learning grounds there is for a close-up guy. I mean, it's just, you're just never going to get better training than that. So
yeah, even working cocktail parties are fine, but in cocktail parties, you're working those occasionally, and it's a little bit different material that you might be using in a walk-around situation, as opposed to a restaurant where if you have a regular gig that you're going to be doing that every Thursday night,
absolutely.
Magic and Martini night, like I did for years, that you're going to be having, doing the magic and doing the same things. I like to do a few different things, because if a table says, hey, come over and see our table next, they were probably watching your set there, so I try to do something completely different.
Oh, right. And plus, I used to do, when I was first getting my career off the ground, I was doing a happy hour at a couple different nightclubs that were connected to fine dining restaurants, surrounded by office buildings. And basically, these office buildings at 5 o'clock would empty out, and I was in the bar doing magic there. And you got the same people, week in,
that's
week
a good
out,
point. And they've already seen what you've done.
So they've already seen the good stuff. And sometimes they want to see the same thing again. Yeah. But sometimes, you don't want to just keep tipping your hand like that. So
exactly.
So you do have to keep stuff fresh. And that was a challenge for me. Yeah.
What do you do in a case like that? I mean, years ago, when Cigarette Through Quarter came out, kind of a thing, and everybody said, bring their friends in. Hey, that this guy put a cigarette through the quarter. Can you do that for my friend? Well, first of all, he's going to be watching from a different angle because it's not going to be a surprise. And now it's not a surprise to them because he's told you it's a cigarette through quarter.
Right. This is my buddy Larry. Take his watch.
Exactly. Yeah. Precisely my point.
I think, I don't know whose advice this was, and it's probably a lot of people have said this, but the best advice I got is say, we'll get around to that, and let me show you something else instead that you haven't seen, and then show them something that they hadn't seen, and then work your way back to the thing that they requested.
If they happen to continue to ask you.
Yeah.
Because I do the same thing.
Yeah.
I'll say, I'm going to show you something even better, and then I'll do that, and then if they come back, well, I really would like to see such and such, well, then I will do it. But, it's like Sponge Bunnies or something. It's like, hey, put the bunnies in this guy's hand.
Yeah, thankfully I'm bad. Thankfully I'm bad enough that after they see one trick, they're done. They're like, no, we're good.
No. Well, what's it like in England now? Have you worked in any restaurants or doing any kind of, have you ever done?
No, I haven't done a whole lot in England. I've done, when I first moved to England, I was on ships all the time. Mm-hmm. And I did a little bit of close-up when we were back home. But the close-up in England, there's two things that they have that's pretty popular. They have drinks receptions, which is kind of like the cocktail parties when everyone's standing around with a plate of food in one hand and a drink in the other hand. And sometimes it's a before-dinner thing.
Yeah, and they call it a drinks reception, not a cocktail
reception,
party.
It's a drinks reception, meaning kind of like it's the pre-dinner
cocktail hour.
Yeah, cocktail hour.
But they call it interesting.
A drinks reception. Cool. And that I like. That I live and breathe in that environment. Mm-hmm. But then after that, then the other really common thing is they'll have these big banquet tables, 10, 12 people at a table. Big centerpiece in the middle, and a small army of magicians that have to run in. And in England, they do these like 5-6-course meals. Mm-hmm. And you have to jump in there and try to get a card trick out right before their pork chop comes or right before their appetizer comes. I think it's the worst kind of work in the world. I don't know if Darren Brown said it in one of his books. He said, you're basically one step above the guy who's selling roses. And
I read that.
I would argue that you're not even that, because the guy who's selling roses at least leaves you with something of value. So you're basically a trick machine. Half the people are watching you kind of over their shoulder, and it's not pleasant work. So I kind of don't do much of that. So I most of what I've done in England is figure out ways to do more corporate work back in the States, which okay. I do a lot. And then I do a lot of comedy festivals and arts festivals.
You ever done Fringe Festival?
Yeah, I did the Edinburgh Fringe Festival twice.
Tell me about that. What's that like?
That is the hardest work for the least amount of money you will ever make.
That's encouraging. Everybody should try for that.
I think it's something that every magician who aspires to do their own show or do a stage show needs to do, because first of all, it's very humbling, because you're in a city where you and 3,000 other acts are competing for the same audience.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's on a street corner handing out flyers. Everybody's standing in the rain trying to get people into their show. You have to hustle, hustle, hustle just to get people in their show. And the first year I did it, I had the largest venue in the Free Fringe. It was a 220, 230 seat theater.
Wow, that was big.
And I had a couple opportunities where that thing was full, and I had a couple opportunities when there was like 5 people in the audience.
Wow.
And there's no rhyme or reason to it. It's hard work, but it definitely makes you take stock of what you're doing. And you know, the minute I think, you know, oh, I'm a superstar, you just go and do the Fringe and you realize you're not all that.
You're just another number.
Yep, you're another guy out there. And the Fringe Festival now has become, at least the Edinburgh Fringe, is becoming almost a magic festival. Every other act out there is a magic act.
Really?
And it's tough, because it's always been very comedy-based. And so a lot of guys, you know, they'll go to Edinburgh for the Fringe Festival. They'll see shows. If they see a bad comedian, they'll go, oh, that was a bad comedian. I'll go see a different comedian.
Right.
If they see a bad magic act, they go, oh, yeah, I don't want to see another magic act.
Yeah, they've had enough.
For whatever reason, and I'm sure you've dealt with this like with corporate audiences, mm-hmm. where you're talking to a client on the phone and they say, we had a magician 1 year, it didn't work out that well.
Yes, we're not having him back.
But you never but you never hear someone say, well, I heard a bad band one time, so I don't listen to music anymore.
I just had this conversation with someone within the last week. What was the deal? That he was at a table of 3 ladies, or maybe it was a cocktail party or something. The point was that 2 of them asked for his card, and he had it out, and he was going to hand it to this other lady. She said, I don't like magicians. We had one in our, exactly what you said, one at a party, and I'm never going to hire another one.
Right, right.
Well,
right.
You know, and so he didn't take the adversarial obvious thing that you can say, well, you know, I don't like music either, because I listened to it once.
It's an argument you can't win. No. So, But for whatever reason, we're viewed as all cut from the same cloth.
That's right.
I kind of don't know where that came from, and
I'll tell you where I think it is.
Yeah.
And see if this holds water. And I think it's because people don't like to be fooled, even though some magicians hand out cards saying it's fun to be fooled.
The old Will Goldstein, or was it Will Goldstein? Or?
I think it was Goldstein.
Yeah.
Goldstein. Yeah. I think you're right. But I don't think people do, particularly nowadays, and that's why that with the advent of YouTube and the internet and everything else, from which the people can go and find the secrets. And so if they feel they are fooled, I'm going to go figure out how that's done. Because they say, how'd you do that? And you'll say, you know, very well, or whatever kind of a funny answer you want to give. Well, they really want to know, and now they can go and really find out. And which is the reason, of course, you don't want to give away the names, like this is a silk trick, or, you know, the name of the trick that you're doing, because then they'll go do the, you know, research and find that out. But my point is that I think that there are people who just feel that, particularly alpha males or alpha females, when these people feel as if that they are being made a fool of, and they don't understand what
how that trick was done, and they feel tricked as opposed to be entertained, even though that the same people are seeing and hearing the same trick. If they are looking at it from a puzzle standpoint, and the others are looking at it of, hey, this, we're at a movie, we're just having fun, this is there, it's an actor doing a part, etc. But this person, one person is looking at it from a puzzle, I'm going to, by golly, figure this out. And if they can't figure it out, then it's like, I don't want to ever hire another magician because we didn't like him, you know. And it could be they're subliminally thinking, I just don't want to be fooled.
I think you could be onto something. I used to do quite a lot of trade shows, and the hardest ones I did, I worked for a medical device company, and doing medical trade shows were the hardest trade shows I've ever done.
Why is that?
Because these are doctors. These are masters of time, space, and dimension. These are, you know, they're gods with your life in their hand.
Yep.
And boy, they were just, they were stone-faced. They were not an easy audience by any
They felt like that they
means.
Were being, they didn't understand, so they felt like they were.
It's like they were all British or something. It was just, That's the other thing, too, the British audiences. It's such a challenge because we're spoiled in America. The difference in America, I was one of the cruises I was on one time, cruise director, a friend of mine from Wales, she said, you know, if the passenger manifest is mostly Americans or Australians, I know it's going to be a fun cruise. If it's British, it's going to be hard work. And I don't classify all British audiences the same. I think there's a difference between the young British audiences and the old British audiences. But the old British audiences, it's, you have to win them over, and it takes a long time. And it's very hard to get, especially comedy-wise, get the ball rolling and keep it rolling.
Well, they say that the humor is different, appreciated differently in England than it is here.
Well, the way she put it, and I really believe this is true, because comedians, they rate audiences, national audiences. And Americans, Australians, Canadians, they're always like first, second, third, and the British, they come in like 52-53.
Wow.
And I'm not sure who's in the middle. They're probably Malaysians.
But, so you can tell there's an audience out there because they cast a shadow.
Oh, basically. My God. Yeah. But it's one of those things where she said, it's interesting because if there's a program, it says, oh, there's a, you know, if it's an American audience, they'll read it and go, oh, there's a comedian on tonight. Let's go see what he's got.
Yeah.
And if it's British audiences, they go, oh, there's a comedian on tonight. Let's go see what he's got. So it's very much a challenge. All right, make me laugh.
Yeah.
You know, whereas the American audiences, I think they're behind you from the very beginning, unless you screw up and then they'll turn on you. Yeah. Whereas the British audiences,
you have to prove yourself.
You got to prove yourself first, and then once you win them over, then you're okay. But it takes you know, half the show just to get them going. So.
Well, I was working on the Silver Seas, and it was predominantly a British audience.
I worked Silver Seas. That's a tough line.
It was a very tough line. I thought it would be a little bit easier than it was, and I was trying to do a little pre-show, and I must have talked to six people, and it's like, no, don't be talking to me. You know that I'm not going to help you.
Yeah.
Well, come on.
They're very full of themselves on that line.
Seems to be. Probably. Yeah. Wasn't the best experience. Anyhow, working cruises for the number of years you did, that you were single, I guess, then at the time?
No, actually, I was married. So, and that was one of the reasons why I kind of closed the door on it. I mean, part of it was circumstances, and part of it was just it wasn't sustainable for a lasting relationship. You know, what was nice was I'd be gone for a while, but then when I was home, I was actually home. So, you know, I didn't have to go off to work the next morning. I didn't go bowling with my buddies. I just, you know, I was home with my wife, and that was great. And my wife has a full-time business too, so she was always busy. So, so that was all right.
So she couldn't really travel with you or go out to the on the ships?
No, she went on a couple of cruises with me. She went on one to Norway, and then she went on a seaborne ship throughout the Greek islands with me once, and that was really nice. Once she found out on seaborne that there was going to be some young guy following her around with a bottle of champagne the whole cruise, she was good.
Hey, so, I'm all in.
Yeah, exactly.
So did you meet her actually when you were on the ship?
Or? I actually met her. I did a UK lecture tour. It was after my first Scandinavian tour and before my first European tour. I did a UK lecture tour, and she's a very talented amateur magician. Not a big performer, just loves the art, and she you know, do stuff for her friends and stuff. And she was a member of the Birmingham Magic Club
So she had magic.
Yeah. So after my lecture, my handler there and I and she and a couple other people went out for dinner, and you know, we just hit it off.
Great. Yeah.
And then we did the transatlantic thing for about a year and a half, and one of us had to move, and my doctor said I wasn't getting enough moisture, so I moved to the UK.
Yeah, I did a lecture tour for a couple weeks in the UK, and I remember there were 2 days I think when it rained solid, and trying to get my things in and out of the car. It's just at one point, I don't swear, but I did then. I was a little upset with it. It's like nothing you can do about the weather, but darn this weather, you know, come on.
Yeah.
Kids when's it going to let up?
Kids in England don't age, they mold.
I can certainly understand that. And so where were you in the U.S.? Were you in the Midwest? Were you like
I was just outside of Minneapolis.
Minneapolis,
St. Paul, yeah. Uh-huh. It was a Twin City Boys. Yeah.
Did you get really involved with the Magic Club when you were in Minnesota then?
Not a lot. I actually do more. I did more conventions and more Magic Clubs once I moved to the U.K. because it was something my wife was excited about doing. But for the most part in the Twin Cities, there's a really vibrant Magic community. I knew most of the guys. I would go to the Magic Club once a year when they had their auction, and every once in a while when there was a lecture I really wanted to see. But I wasn't an active, really, club member. I was too busy working. And, and magic clubs aren't always conducive to creativity and pushing you forward. So
I understand where you're going with that. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. When you were working, were you working at a restaurant back then?
No, by then I was...
Max Nerma's or something?
I was doing trade shows, and I was doing I was doing a lot of corporate stuff. So I was a top pick for Clean Comedians at the time, and I was also working for... Funny Business and Eagle Talent Connection, and those three agencies
kept you busy.
I mean, it was roaring back. This was like we're talking 2006, 2007. So I didn't at one point I forgot to even get business cards printed because literally the phone would ring. I'd pick it up and they'd say, "Can you fly to Houston on in 2 weeks on Thursday?"
So you're all over the place.
Yeah, so
keep
I was
as busy
just,
as you
yeah,
want to be.
Yeah, so that was great. And that was the nice thing about Minneapolis. It was a major hub for Delta, and
I
could just fly anywhere from there. Yeah. So yeah.
Well, going back to cruise ships, I was just having a conversation with someone earlier about how the cruise ship business had changed significantly as to what they pay now versus what they did even 10 years ago. You know, and so was that in part why that you had left as well?
No, part of it was I was working for I won't mention any names, but I was working for an agency. I'd transferred from an agency on the East Coast to an agency in the UK because it made more sense
because
that's where I was going to be based.
Right.
And they kept me really busy initially, and it was all European cruises, mostly some Asian cruises. And then the work started to peter out, and I would see this agency that I worked for start putting really bad acts on, like these young sopranos who'd never sung in front of people, it seems like. And
were they cheap?
I think so. I think they were starting to get a bit of a reputation. And so for whatever reason, my work started to peter off. And then I switched to a different agent. So I was now on to my third cruise agent. So that's a bit of a kiss of death. And he just kind of didn't get me anything. And I think it's one of those things. I worked for Princess and Holland American mostly. And I think it's one of those things where you're the flavor of the week for a while. And then they just get somebody else in. And I think I was at the high end of the pay scale at the time, and they could a combination of they could find out that they could get guys a lot cheaper, and they started some of these ships started to put in magic production shows.
Oh yes.
So basically, the singers and dancers on the ship would basically come out and do the magic. So you know,
it's just plug and play. They buy the illusions, and then they
exactly
like
what happened
park.
With theme parks. Yeah, back in the day when I think Doug Anderson was doing a lot of theme
That's
parks.
That's right. And, yeah, because they would just train these guys. You know, the Paul Osborne would make the illusions basically, and then they would go to Great American Theme Park or something and hire college kids who were in theater for the summer to get some experience dancing and singing.
Yeah, and they get like $500 a week or something, and that was big money for them.
Big money. And so, I can kind of see the death of that. But then my friend was telling me also the same thing like with comedians, that they're obviously starting to book more comedians because they don't have to ship a lot of stuff. They would do
All my stuff was always – I was always a fly-on act. I never had the big props on the ship. The other night in Louisiana, I was visiting with
Chip
Romero.
You saw his collection, didn't you?
And boy – And he's boy, has he got some props.
yes, he does.
And you know, he was on Grand Princess for a long time, I think he told me. And he had a proper illusion show on there. But, you know, it's hard. It's hard to find the ships that put the big illusion shows on there now. So everything I did fit in the overhead on a plane. Otherwise, it just didn't go in the show. So I was much more of a talking stand-up comedy act with magic. So... I think I worked for Marriott for a while, and one of the guys at Marriott referred to me as like Jerry Seinfeld with magic, and I thought that was a fairly good.
Oh, that's good.
I mean, I wish I had his money and his Porsches, but yeah. But I mean, so when people say, "What do?" I just basically say, "I'm like a stand-up comedian with magic." So
that's a good way of trying to describe that. That's
yeah, yeah. Because yeah. Especially in comedy, there's because I run a comedy night back in the UK where I just basically MC a show and I do like a few little bits, but I bring out other comedians, just straight stand-up comedians. And there's a bit of attitude with comedians still about magicians. And I don't know if it's because sometimes magicians can get it's like when you hire a juggler at a magic convention, you know, and they steal the show because it's something different.
Correct.
But, I mean, the old adage, you know, that if you're a comedy magician, it means you're not funny enough to be a comedian and you're not amazing enough to be a magician. So you become a comedy magician.
Oh, that's interesting.
And, you know, I see kind of where that comes from. But I tell you what, I take both disciplines really seriously. So I have a bit of a chip on my shoulder for that one. But.
Well, I was just talking with Pat Hazel, if you know Pat.
I don't know Pat.
He used to write for Seinfeld, and he's a comedian and magician then as well. And we had this very same conversation, and he was saying that one of the reasons that comics may not like magicians is because they always have a finish. In other words, you're bringing a prop, and regardless what you say or do, the trick's going to come out, and you'll get applause. Whereas if you're a stand-up comic and it's just you standing naked in front of a microphone, the line may or may not draw a laugh. And so if it doesn't...
When that light starts flashing, you got to get off. So yeah.
That's right, too. Yeah, yeah. But in other words, that you're not guaranteed of a finish, whereas a magician is, because you're guaranteed of your trick working at the end.
Oh, I'd not heard that.
Isn't that interesting?
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, different way of looking at that. But... anyhow, where in England do you live?
I'm in Birmingham, which is, if you don't know England, Birmingham is the city where happiness goes to self-harm. So, yeah, it was the heart of the Industrial Revolution of Europe. So it's where everything used to be made. It was steel and gritty and dark. And
the Pittsburgh, right
near what's called, the Black Country, which is, I think it's kind of like one of those depressing cities like Detroit where all the good music comes out of. I think it comes out of that. So Birmingham, I mean, that's where, geez, Led Zeppelin, Moody Blues, Black Sabbath, Duran Duran. I mean, so much music came out of Birmingham. It's crazy. So,
did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do they have a lot of clubs around that still encourage bands to come and play and that kind of thing?
There is a few. But it's not, I don't think there's been that much good music coming out of Birmingham lately. One thing I will say for the UK is if you don't care about making money and you just want opportunities to practice in front of live audiences, there's lots of cabaret opportunities.
Unlike the US. We don't have cabarets or nightclubs the way that they do.
No, it's just not a thing.
Explain that for people in the US who don't understand that difference there.
Yeah, like so lots of like comedy clubs or lots of different bars will have like an open mic night, and it's not just people that are telling jokes. If somebody wants to come out and do spoken word, or if they want to come out and play an instrument, or if they want to just come out and do some magic, it's great. You can literally go pretty much every night of the week and find some place, some bar, some nightclub, some restaurant, some pub where they're doing a comedy night, or a lot of bars are really amenable to, if you just want to go in there and just say, hey, listen, I see you got a stage in the corner, you got a couple lights hanging from the ceiling and a microphone stand, how about we do a magic night? And a lot of places, you know, if it doesn't cost them anything, they're like, go for it, and we'll give you, we'll do, or we got a private room, we'll do an eight pound ticket price, and we'll split it, and so there's a lot of opportunity for that. Again, if you're not worried about making money,
but getting some experience, like we were talking about earlier, we really don't have a place where you can do a show over and over, but you might find two or three clubs you can line up and go from one to the other to get that kind of experience.
Absolutely.
And another, I remember Paul Daniels telling me about working the working man's clubs way back when, and they paid you okay, but it was difficult because you're working with some people who are just hardcore blue collar workers, you know, who are not interested in seeing a magician. They're there for the lottery, you know, to win the ham or whatever.
They're sitting at the table drinking beer, and they're going to keep drinking beer and keep talking while you're doing your show.
Right.
The working men's club market is kind of not what it used to be. There's not as much of that anymore. But what they do still have is holiday camps, and holiday camps will be like
Blackpool.
No, Blackpool is like an actual city, but these will be like out kind of in the country somewhere, and there's a couple different companies that have them, and think of it like a cruise ship on land. That's basically okay. what it is.
And so it's a temporary thing, actually.
No, it's a regular holiday camp. So they'll run it, you know, throughout the year, but they'll just have, you know, you'll just book a week at this camp. Like one of the big ones is called Bucklands, and all the
maybe
guys
like Poconos or something. Maybe.
Yeah, exactly. All the guys there wear blue jackets. Think Poconos back in like say the 1960s.
Okay,
that kind of thing. So yeah.
Gotcha.
So there's a lot of that, but those are really hard audiences too, because like I said, it's a room full of people all eating and drinking. You come out and do your show, they're still eating and drinking, and the kids are running roughshod over the place, and they're going to keep talking. And I know a couple of guys. I got a buddy of mine, Mark James, who's really successful at doing these. Yeah,
I was going to book him for a lecture tour, and we were getting together, and then he got booked for a cruise ship line. He said, I'm going to be gone for the next 6 months, so let's do this later. And I'd love to have him.
Book him when you can, because he's great. Yeah. And he's figured out, he's sort of cracked the code of the whole holiday camp. He does it as well as anyone I know.
Good.
But you know, there's good nights and bad nights. I mean, it's a tough crowd. It's a tough crowd.
Well, another thing I'd heard, of course, that is really popular for UK magicians, or at least a venue to work, are weddings, which are different over there than what they are here. Whereas I understand that's like a day-long kind of a thing.
Well, you know, this is something I've kind of struggled with, because I thought about weddings years ago, because I was watching I was sitting in my dentist's office and they had like Oprah Winfrey on or something. And there was a woman on the show, and she was a wedding planner, and she was talking about, you know, when you're spending money on your wedding, you know, spend it on the things that people are going to pay attention to, or the things, rather not pay attention to, but the things that are going to leave people with a memory. So she said, so think about, I don't know, hiring a magician. And I wish I had that clip, because that'd be a nice thing to have on a website. But the format for weddings there isn't really much different than the format for weddings here. It's, you know,
because I've talked to a couple guys and they said, well, I've worked like the breakfast at a wedding, and then I would go home and come back and work in the afternoon when they're doing the reception.
Well, the wedding breakfast, that threw me off when I first moved to the UK too. The wedding breakfast doesn't mean that you're doing it a breakfast time. The wedding breakfast is the dinner.
Oh.
For whatever reason, they call it breakfast. And they also call dinner over there tea. So I don't get that either. You know, what are you having for tea? And I always said, tea.
So
the wedding breakfast is just the wedding meal, and the big time to have magicians do stuff is sometimes at the meal, but oftentimes it's when the bride and groom are having their picture taken. The rest of the attendees are just kind of milling about visiting, or they'll have like we were saying earlier, a drinks reception. They'll have a cocktail hour, and a lot of times that's when the bride and groom and the attendees and stuff are getting their pictures done and stuff. So it's kind of a downtime, dead time. And I've talked to more and more people in the States here that do close-up who've just started doing more weddings. But I always thought, God, the guy who cracks that market, he's going to own it here.
I would agree. And I've tried that a long time ago. In fact, I was contacted, it's been 10 years ago, by the not Wall Street Journal, but New York Times. And they were doing something in like a Sunday edition. And they were talking about weddings and entertainment and things outside the box instead of a DJ or a band, wedding band. What else have you got? You know, I mean, people who are character artists and that kind of a thing. But they mentioned magicians. They called me because on my website that I've got, weddings is one of the things that I do. And I'm also ordained, so I can marry people. And then also, in fact, I'm doing one next weekend in Dallas. So I'm going to be not only marrying him, but afterwards to do a reception, you know, for them. So I try and tie the two then together, if at all possible. And I did one time as a mentalist. In fact, that it was kind of funny that I had a lady who had contacted me and said they had seen a mentalist and they really wanted to have one for their wedding. And the fact that you can marry us two, that'd be great. Like two in one kind of a thing.
Wow.
It's like, that was strange. And it was on a Sunday morning at 11. So it wasn't like, okay, well, anyhow. So they're kind of limited as to the people who were going to be coming into for the thing. It was about 60 or 70 people, but that's unusual, certainly to have a mentalism specifically with that. I mean, and not a walk-around mentalism, but actually a show. In other words, after people, I've married them, they go and have a seat, and then they're going to have lunch, and afterwards I'm going to do this stand-up mentalism
show. I've done
a
few cabarets that way at weddings,
But I've never really cracked that either, trying to get in and do more of that, and I just don't know what it's about. And, you know, I mentioned, by the way, earlier about going and doing a lecture series in the UK, and I talked about being ordained. You can go online and get ordained and whatnot, and they said that doesn't fly over here because apparently that weddings have to be done. You can't be ordained that way.
It's not who marries you, it's where you're married.
It's where you're married, and also what time. Apparently that they can't be married after dark.
Oh, I don't know about that.
But
it definitely has to be in a listed building.
Okay.
So a lot of people have what basically what my wife and I did, we did our, what we call our theatrical wedding, which was in our back garden with our friends and our family and stuff. And then they get married at like the registrar's office the next day or the day before.
Oh, okay.
We did it a little differently. We actually got married at the Magic Castle. Mm-hmm. And that was largely for legal reasons. And then we got married again in the UK so that my wife's family could be there and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I got a good friend at the castle, Rich Cowley, who's also a celebrant. And so he can marry people, but he can also be the magician at the wedding. So mm-hmm. I don't know if he's tried that. But a dear friend of mine in the UK by the name of Sam Fitton has written a book called The Golden Rules. I'm going to probably butcher this. Sorry, Sam. Golden Rules of Wedding Magic. Hmm. It's a small paperback. It's a quick read, but boy, has he figured this out. So if anyone listening to this is interested in getting into wedding magic, I can't recommend that book highly enough. I met Sam. We did the Edinburgh Fringe Festival together. And so he does lots of weddings, and he gets paid very well for it. And he's got a system down. So
what's the title of the book again?
I believe it's called The Golden Rules of Wedding Magic.
Never heard of it.
Yeah.
Well. Does it apply for magicians in the U.S. as well as the U.K.?
I think it would apply for either equally as well, just okay. Because, you know, the wedding, like I said, the format isn't really different. Mm-hmm. Do they have wedding fairs over here?
Yes. Okay. And I've done a lot of those also. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I've gotten connected with a place that specializes. I mean, it's a restaurant, but they specialize in weddings. And they have a bunch of different banquet rooms depending upon what size the wedding's going to be.
Okay.
And they have engaged me then basically kind of on retainer as being the officiant. So
okay.
A lot of times people are getting married there, and so they contact me to go and do that. And then I try to, you know, push for doing weddings as well. So that's one of my tips, is if you can,
right.
is to connect with wedding planners like that.
Right, right.
And if you can, a wedding venue, which is even better.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because the wedding planner is going to be doing some also, but the wedding venue is going to have several going on at the same time. So you can go from one to the other in the same building. You don't have to travel any place.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. There's like the wedding fairs in the UK are basically just like trade shows where people go and they'll book their cake and their magician and their venue and that kind of stuff. But then there's also another thing, and he mentions it in the book, and my mind is not going to remember this, but it's something like taster night or something. But it's basically where a specific wedding venue, just like what you said, will bring in like sort of their preferred suppliers. You
correct. Know, their they have videographers and they have DJs and everybody, and then the people go around. And typically what we do is we'll give away something for free. They'll say, you know, they got, well, particularly like people who are selling cake, you know, or whatever, say taste the cake and they've got some things, you know, like that. So they'll have wedding fairs, that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great ideas. Yeah.
Yeah. Those are things I think that you should, show, you know, when you have an opportunity, if you really want to find that market, you know.
And the nice thing about doing weddings is everybody's there. Everyone who's there is in a good mood. Everyone's there
to have
a good
time.
It's the happiest audience in the world, you know.
Yeah.
And if you can figure out a way to make the wedding special for the bride and groom, and Sam talks about this in his book, how basically, you know, a lot of wedding pictures are just pictures of people sort of standing around drinking, but he'll talk to the photographer ahead of time and say, now you might want to follow me because you'll get reaction shots. And the shots that the photographers get of not the magician, but the people reacting to the magician,
yes.
You know, to see their friends and family later on in their album looking like that.
I've told the photographer the same thing. Like, I'm going to do some sponge bunnies. I mean, I want you to watch me, first of all, so you can see what the reaction
what happened,
is. So you'll know where to get that. I've had that same thing. Yeah. And I instruct them to do that. Exactly right. That they're going to be getting better reaction shots rather than to stand around. And, of course, the way that you sell the thing is to tell them that this is an opportunity for your guests and your families to kind of get to know each other. Because typically you have people of diverse interest and also like one family versus another, and people don't know each other. So it's a good icebreaker and conversation starter, you know, for you to come in during the reception. And also good for young and old. Doesn't matter if they're, and you know, grandmother in a wheelchair or, you know, an 8-year-old kid, you know, or whatever. So.
And Sam also has like, he always, you know, mentions doing one thing just for the bride and groom that turns into a photo opportunity. And I'm not going to tip what his thing is because I'm not at liberty to, but basically the photo he gets of the bride and groom,
definitely is going to go in their
album.
A
lot of people will use that as a cover of their photo album.
Wow.
It's just that good. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you know, of course, the traditional trick that always goes over great is just the anniversary waltz, you know, that Doc Eason sells, and just a great trick. And there are different variations, you know, on that thing, too, but that is a keeper because people will keep that card, you know, in their wedding album then as well.
No doubt.
Yeah. So anyhow, as far as the things that you're doing then right now, so you're driving, you're traveling back and forth a lot from the UK to the US.
And after doing this for this long, partly because of my wife's business, but partly because of just my business, just more opportunity. We're looking at relocating this year back to the United States.
Back to the U.S. Yeah. Okay, so she can actually do that here?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. What she does is, yeah, it's going to be very applicable. We're looking at Los Angeles because, you know, the house prices in Texas just aren't high enough. So
I was going to say, well, why not here? Yeah. Yeah.
But
if you buy a place in L.A. and you can afford that, then you can move back to Texas and buy a much bigger place.
I'm looking at a lovely two-bedroom cardboard box under a bridge under in L.A. a bridge right now. And yeah, I think
you better hurry.
I think it's going to be, yeah. It's, boy, I tell
you
I'm sure
the realtors are showing that, and it's like, oh, sorry, that one's gone.
I'm from Minnesota. I mean, I look at the house that I had before I moved. I'm like, I could buy that and move it to L.A. cheaper
for the price.
Than I could. Yeah, it's, I don't know how people in L.A. can afford to do it. But, you know, lo and behold, that's what we're going to try
to do. I think it's one of the reasons, you know, we're in Austin, Texas as we record this
By the way, my in-laws don't know that we're doing this yet, so please don't tell them.
Don't tell them to listen to this podcast. Living in Austin, Texas, and we've had a lot of people move here to Texas, and Austin in particular. It's getting to be a new tech valley here, Valley area. Yeah. And as people come over from California, have been buying up places and thinking, oh, really? That's only $1.5 million? I'll take that. You know, it's a great place. You're
I got a brother in Longmont, Colorado. Same thing happened to Colorado years ago. All these people that made all their money in their real estate in California sold and bought in Colorado and drove all the property values up as well.
Sure. I've got to think that the property values in California eventually got to crash. You know, I don't know when, but it keeps going up and up.
I don't see it crashing, but I tell you what, like Newport Beach, man, that was one of the few recession-proof areas. You know, when the housing crash happened in like 2009 or so, for whatever reason, Newport Beach just kept climbing and climbing. So.
Yeah, well, of course, New York City, for some reason, the same reason. I don't understand. I was just talking to a buddy of mine, Shep Hyken, or not Shep, but Seth Kramer, and Seth was telling me about a friend of his bought a place that is 1,600 square feet. It had a good view and everything, but two or three bedrooms and everything. It was $12.5 million, you know, in a high rise. Said, what?
Wow.
For 1,600 square feet?
That's crazy.
Okay.
It's like London prices are the same way. I mean, you know, people have said, if you're, you know, you're in Birmingham, why not move to London?
Yeah.
I'm like, well, it's a lot more money for the same weather. And I had a really good friend I used to do ships with quite a lot. He was a really, really talented clarinet player. He used to do this Benny Goodman tribute show and stuff. And his name's Pete Neighbors. And he actually, we compared notes one time because he actually met a girl in the United States, fell in love, got married, moved here the same time I fell in love, got married, and moved to the UK. Mm-hmm. So we'd meet up in ports all the time.
So it's net even as far as the US balance to the
Exactly. It's an exchange thing, right? Yeah. So, but I think the US got a better deal personally, but because Pete's a great guy. But we would meet at ports that both of our ships were in from time to time, and we'd compare notes. And he's got a couple of years on me. I'm sure he won't appreciate me saying that. But he said when he was young living in London, he thought the stupidest thing he ever heard people say is when they said, I moved somewhere for the weather. And he said, Tom, that's the only reason to move somewhere. You know, anything else you can fix. The weather, you know, it is what it is. And
you're going to have to live with it.
Growing up in the Midwest, I've been a career snow shoveler since I was about 6 years old, and I'm over it. So,
you know, when I got married, that we had I'm not wild about working out in the yard and getting hot and sweaty and everything, but I do like cold weather. I like to snow ski, and so I've always liked cold weather, and so I don't mind going out and shoveling snow. We lived in Illinois when we first got married, and so I did a lot of snow shoveling, and she did a lot of the mowing, you know, and so it's like, okay, we'll make that deal. I'll shovel the snow, and you can mow the yard. And we gradually moved further and further south, and eventually in Houston, and got rid of the snow shovel, and I made a good deal on that one.
Wow. In the meantime, she's very fit, and you have a beautifully manicured lawn.
That's right. Well, I'm inside kind of giving directions through the window. That doesn't play very well.
Honey, you missed a patch.
Yeah, exactly. I'm coming in to get it then. Get ready.
Oh, funny. Where in Illinois did you live?
Salem, Illinois, which is in southern Illinois. In other words, if you take the way I describe that, people say, oh, New Salem, near Champaign, or, you know, it's no. If you think of Illinois as just, you know, graphically as a state and fold it in half, I'm in the very middle of the southern half.
Okay.
Good way of trying. So I'm about 80 miles east of St. Louis.
Oh, right on. Okay. Yeah.
And so we used to go over there for dinner from time to time because, it was a small farm town, about 6,000 people or so, you know. And, I mean, we used to, on Sundays, drive into Mount Vernon, which was about 25 miles away, to go to Long John Silver's, because that was a big deal, because we didn't have anything like that where I grew up, you know, so that was going out on the town, you know, kind of a thing. So I lived in Illinois, and then from there went to school at SIU, Southern Illinois University, and so I kind of moved on. So that's a little bit about me.
Right on.
About me. What do you think about me?
Well, tell me more about your career.
Yes, right. So do you ever get over to Las Vegas? Have you done some, aside from corporate work?
I used to get there a lot. I haven't been there in ages. I think when my wife Anna and I first got together, we stopped there on the way to LA one time just because she wanted to experience it a little bit. And we went and saw Lance, like I think the last year he was performing
in
Monte Carlo.
Yeah.
And that was great. But I used to go there so often doing trade shows and corporate events.
Yeah.
I remember one time I joked about getting an apartment there because I think I flew to Las Vegas like three times in 1 month. And it's just... Mm-hmm. But yeah, I have not been there very much recently.
Okay. I just wondered if you had recently, because I was just going to ask you about what are your favorite shows or who you've seen or whatever.
I haven't seen
nothing
any shows.
To choose from. Yeah.
No.
Well, but of course, since you're overseas, I guess you don't get over very often.
Not so much. And we have Blackpool, so what?
Well, yeah, when you got 3,500 magicians who go there, you know, that I assume that you've been to the Blackpool convention.
Oh, yeah. It's a zoo.
What was that like this year?
You know, I didn't go this year. This was one of the first years I didn't go. I had a lot of friends who were going, but...
I think I heard there are more people this year than last year, even.
That could be. I mean, I think last year it was about 3,000, so I think they...
That sounds right, because I heard about 3,500.
It's under sort of new supervision now. Russ Stevens.
Derek's not doing it?
No, Russ Stevens and a couple other guys are doing it. And from what I've heard, they're doing a bang-up job of it. So mm-hmm. I mean, Russ is a smart guy, so he knows what he's doing.
Yeah. Well, they got, you know, just the perfect place for that and a good time of the year, I believe.
Is it perfect? I don't know.
Well, from the standpoint that they have at least a lot of places for magicians to stay, you know, and it becomes a magic town, basically, if you will. And so, yeah, perfect from the standpoint that, yeah, no one else wants to be there at that time of the year.
In February, absolutely.
But they do have a lot of hotels around and everything else is kind of going on, you know.
Yes, they do.
That's interesting. Okay, well, listen, as we start to wrap up, I want to thank you very much for being my guest. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, going kind of full circle back, I just happened to notice your T-shirt. We were talking earlier about you being kind of retro, and I got to point out you're wearing electric... It's Tom Comedy.
Tom Peterson presents Electric Comedy. Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was Electric Country or Electric Company. Do you remember the Electric Company that was?
Oh, of course. No.
I thought that was a retro Electric Company shirt.
No, there's a theater in Birmingham. It's the oldest. It's the oldest operating cinema in the UK, and I think it might be the oldest one in Europe. Although there's one in Italy that they're vying for for first place, and it's an old Art Deco film house, and they've got stages, and my wife and I have done events there for a number of years. I've done the Birmingham Comedy Festival there a number of years, and just this last year they said, hey, would you be interested in putting together a comedy night? So, but they said, we'll only do it if you do it as Tom Peterson Presents. So
really?
It's Tom Peterson Presents Electric Comedy, and this is my comedy night that I do.
So where's your name on there? Do I see Tom?
It's really...
Oh, very small.
Probably
there.
Very small, yeah. I'm not...
Okay, so it's not really
not
all about
you. Not a very good self-promoter.
Got it. Yeah, it's more about them. So as I said, start to kind of wrap up, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. So my question is, what is your philosophy? I mean, it doesn't have to be a word, but it could be a sentence. I mean, what is it that's important to you when you wake up in the morning? What is it that kind of drives you for the day? What do you live by to, you know?
That's a good one.
You give other people? Kind of, here's what I do.
Wish I would have gotten these questions in advance.
Well, see, that's why it's always good.
I would probably say that if you're not having as much fun as your audience is, figure out what you're doing wrong, because this is a fun business and you should be enjoying it as much as your audience. If not, it's the wrong business for you. But
how do you know if your audience is having that much fun then?
Well, my audience is usually miserable, so the bar is very low for me. Yeah. I mean, I can wake up and be grumpy and still be better off than that. For me, it's just laughter. You know, if they're laughing and if they ask me after the show, you know, about me and not necessarily about the tricks, that was my other big thing.
That's exactly
was when
the key.
People. I mean, this is really dating myself now, but my goal was to always be, you know, my all time goal was to be on the Johnny Carson show, mm-hmm. and then to be one of the guys that got invited to the couch.
Yeah.
Because that meant you weren't just an interesting trick machine, you were an interesting person. Mm-hmm. And so I knew I started making headway when people would come up to me after a show and not say, "Wow, I really like that one trick," or "You really fooled me with that one." But when they started coming up instead and started asking, "How'd you get into magic?" or "How long have you been doing this?" Mm-hmm. or, you know, or they'd ask questions about me, or, you know, "Were you, did you really do that at one point?" or something. And that's when I felt I was starting to make some headway. So,
right. So the advice is?
The advice is, figure out a way to have as much fun or more fun than your audience is.
Perfect.
And they'll feed off that.
Yep. And it'll be, you can live for life like that, you know, just with happiness. Absolutely. That's the key to happiness.
Absolutely.
That's great. Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott.
Appreciate the time. So with the Magic Word Podcast, that was Tom Peterson. This is Scotty out.
Well, thank you, Tom. I appreciate you being a guest on this week's Magic Word Podcast. This is one that I really would like to go back to from time to time also, because I really enjoyed our conversation and liked what you had to say. And it was not only entertaining, but enlightening as well. It's always fun to talk with you, and look forward to our next visit. One of the things, by the way, I mentioned up front in the podcast was I was thanking people for subscribing to the newsletter. Well, one of the reasons I was is because that as a newsletter subscriber, you find out you're the first one to actually know what's going to be coming up each week and who's going to be coming the following week, and also some suggestions from the archives. But if we happen to have a contest or anything which is going to be coming up, you're the first to know about that too. So this way you make sure that you're going to be able to enter the contest. Well, that's the case this week. We do have a contest thanks to Tom Peterson, who has decided out of the goodness of his heart to give us a copy of his lecture notes. He's got one entitled Atomic Fuel Deceptions, and the other one is called Magic Justice, and it's kind of like a comic book in a way, in that the drawings are all done by him. I mean, not only is he adept as a magician and a performer, but then also as an artist, and it's very entertaining, and I'm sure that you will like it. If you didn't get a copy of his lecture notes when he came to your city to lecture and you wished you would have, well, here's your opportunity to perhaps get a free copy of one of those notes. This contest is going to be open to everyone worldwide. However, let me just say, really, for those, if anyone happens to win who lives outside the United States, then I will contact you with the cost of the shipping. And if you agree to pay for the foreign shipping, then I will send that to you. The notes are free, but you'll pay for the foreign shipping. Otherwise, that's why I'm probably better off to say that this is going to be limited just to citizens or to residents of the United States. So this way that it will be mailed to you free of charge. You get the free lecture, plus the notes will be mailed to you, compliments of the Friends of the Magic Word. That's one of the reasons that I like to have the people who do pledge monthly donations, as well as give us an occasional donation from month to month or time to time. We thank all of you guys, and that is what helps defray our costs, such as mailing out these freebies that we happen to get from our guests from time to time. So first of all, thank you, Tom, very much for offering these two sets of lecture notes to give out to a couple of lucky listeners. And as a reminder, all you need to do is go to themagicwordpodcast.com. There you can see where in this week's blog, there is an entry form where you put in your name and email address, and a copy will be sent to you. I will just point out, by the way, too, that your email address will be provided to Tom Peterson, so this way that he can put it into his newsletter and marketing mix. And I'm certain you will not get spam. If you get an email at all, it's going to be very irregular. And when you do, it's going to be good stuff, because he also includes some free tricks from time to time that are some really darn good tricks. He had a neat little thing here recently that had to do with just one of those little fish, you know, those red fish that curl up in your hand, and a prediction that you do with a card. I'm not going to go any further, but things like that. Anyhow, he kind of puts his newsletter, which, again, I'm going to be providing him with all of the email lists of those people who have entered the contest. And of course, while that you're there, be sure to subscribe to our newsletter if you're not already a subscriber. And if you're not a friend of the Magic Word, there's another opportunity. Just hit that tab that says Become a Friend of the Magic Word and find out how that you can help us with your financial donation or your ongoing monthly pledge just for the cost of a cup of coffee or for a nice single malt scotch each month. It'd be nice. I mean, that it's not going to cost you but just a few bucks. However, the more you pledge, the more perks you get. There are some pretty cool things that you get, including
getting some books and some downloads of lectures and other kinds of things. So you will get some value for your money there as well. So anyhow, I wanted to again thank Tom, and I will be announcing the winner of the contest in an upcoming week. And so, in the meantime, stay well, get booked, and figure out a way to have as much fun or more fun than your audiences. This is Scotty out.